Good afternoon and welcome to the second court of appeals. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel members. To my right is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and to my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Justice Bonnie Sutters. We have three cases set today for oral argument, two at 1:30 and one at 3 o'clock. It's my understanding that the folks for the first case are here and ready, and I'll ask the clerk of the court then to announce the case.
But they didn't commence the petition. They just filed a notice for a ministerial proceeding. where the only thing the statute provides for is a motion for a trial. It doesn't provide for a trial, it doesn't provide for a hearing, it doesn't provide for evidence, it just provides for a motion for trial, or a motion to vacate. And that, under the Michael Stowe case, if it's granted, is immediately appealable. And if that's what was on appeal before this court heard it, gave the parties the opportunity to say, okay, we don't want it dismissed, but nobody filed anything because I got my new trial. And in fact, I believe the jurisdiction lapsed, and therefore they were relegated to remain chapter 35.008. And then we go into...
The whole thing done to the statutory scheme is that you either go through this expedited procedure of filing it and waiting to see if a motion for new trial comes in, or you go, and if a motion for new trial comes in and it's granted, then you can proceed to the petition stages. Is that your understanding of how that statutory scheme is set up?
I don't think there's any other way to read the statute. I don't think there's any other way to read the statute. I think that you have to read the statute that way to make, for anything to make sense. Remember, this is a ministerium, a clerk looks at this and says there's a judgment. So after that, you file a motion for new trial. The court can only make very limited inquiry as to service
and that's basically one of the things that you asked the trial court to do, correct? Was whether your client was correctly served under Pennsylvania law.
Right.
And that was there testimony on that at the August 2016 hearing?
Was there testimony on that? It's not before the court, but there was testimony concerning that, yes. But what we...
I'm just concerned how we can even reach your due process issues if we don't have a transcript to that hearing.
Because of the nature of what this was. The nature of this is a motion for new trial, which you file a motion with affidavit. The court granted it. Okay. It granted it, it said the fee issue. It didn't say, now this is kind of important, what it didn't say is it didn't say for further hearing in this court in this proceeding. It just said for consideration of those issues.
You don't think that was implied for further hearing in that court? But that's what happened.
Certainly read it that way, but you could also read it as if this is for, if you follow the statutory scheme, do a Chapter 38 procedure. And that's the way I read it back in when it was granted, when the motion for new trial was granted. I believe. Well, this is the statute that's
okay. Well, then, by the time the hearing, and I apologize, I agree with you that the Chapter 33 stuff is, you know, it's not. It could be clearer, but when the hearing was being held in August of 2016, obviously you didn't file any sort of original proceeding to stop that, but you were of the opinion at the time that that was some sort of void proceeding?
Yes, we raised that issue that it was a void proceeding.
And the only thing, in your opinion, that Judge Evans could have done in this situation when he granted the motion for the trial was a complete do-over, start up from square one.
No, not complete do-over. They have the right to do a petition under Chapter 35.008. They offer the judgment. That's a pretty simple case for them. They're not put to a due process thing, but it's an evidentiary thing, proceeding where you can get some discovery, where you can do the... Remember, this proceeding, this ministerial proceeding, doesn't allow for discovery, doesn't allow for... I'm up here in Fort Worth, and this case has nothing to do with Fort Worth. I couldn't
say anything. So this motion for a trial is really a misnomer. In other words, you file your notice for a judgment, and you wait for your 30 days if the motion for a trial comes in. If denied, if it comes in and denied, then it's a good judgment, it's valid, takes the judgment. If the motion for new trial is granted, then it sets it aside. They have to go down the petition route. There's not really a new trial. There's just a petition proceeding that can be a better one in that circumstance.
I'm not the legislature. I didn't write it that way. But they wrote it, vacate, new trial. The Mindus Metal case interprets it as a vacation of the illness. They don't say it rules on the merits. The court cannot, in this type of proceeding, say anything's wrong with Pennsylvania judgment, it doesn't have authority to do that. There's no jurisdiction. Now, in fact, it could.
But the motion for new trial itself is a misnomer, really. The granting of a motion for new trial doesn't really give you a new trial.
It doesn't really give you any new trial, except to the extent that you would have a...
Are now available to go petition if you want to go petition.
I didn't like the statute, but that's where I find some confusion in the statute. But the only way this whole thing, the whole scheme makes sense to you, if this is an administrative proceeding, and you file within your time limit, then that, and if you're successful as a party, then that puts the other side to the burden of, let's get this judgment, the validity of this judgment determined, or registered, or enforced in court by petition under Rule 22 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure by petition. And wherein we can have discovery, wherein I can go and say, I want to transfer venue because this case has nothing to do with Fort Worth. The account was done in the supposed underlying claim arose in Baytown, Texas. It has nothing to do with Fort Worth, but there's no procedure to challenge venue. There's no procedure to do discovery. There's no procedure to do anything other than your motion to vacate or your motion to new trial. I also want to talk about the other esoteric portion of the civil practice and remedies code, and that's dormant judgment. If you look at 34.001, a writ of execution not executed within 10 years, it takes the judgment dormant. Okay? Under Texas law, this judgment at that time of the proceeding was dormant. So there was no ability, the court would have erred in entering a judgment because on its face it's dormant.
Well, what's your best case on that one, counsel?
What's my base case on that?
Best case. Because I thought in filing the notice to domesticate the judgment in the 10-year time period would be good enough. So tell me what, give me some authority for the proposition you just gave us that has to be executed within the 10 years.
Okay, I can read from the statute, I probably would.
Do you have a case side?
I do not have a case.
Okay, thank you.
Do you believe that, I know the judge didn't do that in this case, but do you believe that had the trial court not acted and not granted the new trial, that would have been denied by operation of law 75 days later?
Yes.
So you think that rule is operational under the circumstances?
Yes, I think it's been denied as law, but under the matter of law. I think there's a number of cases that say that. The other statute to look at, and that's Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Section 16.066. And that says that an action on a foreign judgment is barred if the action is barred under the laws of the state or the jurisdiction, or an action against a person who has resided in the state for 10 years to the action may not be brought on a foreign judgment rendered more than 10 years before the commencement of the action. And the key word in there is rendered, and the case law that we cite in our brief talks about rendered is not the Texas court's registration or acknowledgement of the judgment. Rendered is when the foreign court actually says, this is my decision on the merits. So 10 years from that day is the last day you can do anything on the foreign judgment.
So that would have been in 2016?
That would have been in 2016, yeah. And that's it. That's under Section 16.066. Time is barred. Texas says that under their statutes, for a scheme that you can, you can approach your sister's safe judgment, but you need to do it within 10 years.
Okay. And I realize this is not your case, but theoretically then, a judgment debtor from another state that had a creditor that domesticated that judgment here in Texas within 10 years, and then let's say that the judgment debtor did who knows what sorts of things to delay, slow down, and appeals, and up and down, and all that sort of stuff, could that judgment debtor then come back more than 10 years later and say, oh, you didn't really do anything like you should have done within 10 years, and therefore I'm off the hook?
They made an absolute time off. There's no exceptions. There's a fraudulent transfer. It's one of those statute of repose. This is a statute of repose. It just goes away.
What are we supposed to do with the fact that Pennsylvania has a 25-year statute of repose? How does that play into this analysis?
Well, then if Pennsylvania I don't necessarily agree that their statute of repose is 25 years. I think that's a fairly complicated issue without it wasn't agreed. But if they want to try to enforce the Pennsylvania judgment in Pennsylvania, that's Pennsylvania's jurisdiction. It's what the issue before this court is whether Texas courts enforce the Pennsylvania judgment. And under section 16.666, it is time bound. So that doesn't mean that they can't go to Pennsylvania and get rid of it. Doesn't mean they can't go to Pennsylvania and get rid of it. Doesn't mean we can't go to Pennsylvania and challenge the judgment there. But we're talking about the esoteric provision of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code applicable to foreign judgment. And 16.066 is a statute of repose. It says 10 years and we're done.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson.
My name is Christopher Orisco, and I, along with Mr. Fonda, represent Delauder Landon Financial Services. We'll be providing a response to Mr. Pierce's argument on appeal. I will discuss issues 1 through 4 set forth in the applicant's brief, those issues being what the trial court's sua sponte order granting the appellant's motion for new trial, the judgment was void for lack of jurisdiction, whether that was an interlocutory order. I will be addressing the statute of limitations issue that was set forth by Mr. Pierce, as well as in addition to that, the buoyancy or alleged buoyancy of the Pennsylvania judgment. While Mr. Fronda, in turn, will address the waiver argument, regulation of care issues, and service of process. Before I jump into that first issue regarding the nature of the trial court's order granting motion for the trial, I want to highlight one thing for the court, and that is, in Texas, when you domesticate a foreign judgment, it is generally granted full faith and credit, and is prima facie enforceable, absent a very narrow list of defenses. And in fact, a party resisting the enforcement of the foreign judgment must do so by clear and convincing evidence, which is, as we know, a higher standard than that of the preponderance of the evidence. I'd like to also highlight the fact that in this case, the domesticated Pennsylvania judgment at all times remained a valid and enforceable Texas judgment. In other words, the trial court never entered any order in this case that stated the Pennsylvania judgment was vacated, that it was rendered unenforceable. In fact, what it said is going to, and I'm quoting, it's therefore ordered that a motion for a new trial is granted to determine that the judgment is void for lack of jurisdiction. The court certainly has the power to make that inquiry. In fact, I'd like to direct this court's attention to the case of Minuteman Press International versus Fargas. In that case, the enforcement of the foreign judgment that they find is governed by the Texas version of the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act. And they further noted that in interpreting the act, courts have held that the enforcing state may make a reasonable inquiry into a sister state's judgment, and that the jurisdiction parties before the judgment won't be accepted.
But isn't the clock ticking during that period of time? Doesn't the court have to do that rather quickly? Is it really allowed to be carried over from this length of time during this, under this statute?
The court should be given the flexibility to arrange its schedule as it sees fit. I will cite the case I was just reading, Ware versus Everest, in which the parties were testing factual issues that arose in the investigative foreign judgment setting.
What happens when the motion is granted? If the trial court grants the motion for the trial, then what happens?
Well, the language of the order is important. If the trial court grants the motion,
outright grants it.
If it outright grants it, then you follow what it says. And I would concede that it's vacated and enforceable, and the proper remedy would be to build a new condo.
So if the court doesn't do that, isn't the application then denied by operation of law 75 days later?
Not in this particular case, because the language of the trial court order is important. It's interlocutory in nature, which means it's not appealable. In fact, in the case of Mendez Meadows, it tells us what a final appealable order looks like. In that case, and let me quote their language that they use, and I'll quote, "A foreign judgment filed by Mendez is not returned to the faith of pressure and is not enforceable in the state of Texas, and that the filing of a foreign judgment is of no consequence or effect." So in that case, yes, the proper remedy would be to timely appeal. But in the current case, the judgment of the trial court's order granting the trial is interlocutory. In fact, there is statutory authority that grants the trial court the ability to do a reasonable inquiry as set forth in the Mendez case. That is section 35.
Well, isn't the filing of the foreign judgment like, isn't it equivalent to the judgment in a case being signed? And doesn't the clock start ticking? The clock start ticking just as if on the day that was filed, the judgment was signed. So that you've got 30 days to take a motion for a new trial.
The answer is when you file a domesticated judgment, that action goes to judicial pleading and the final Texas judgment.
Right.
Case.
That's a final judgment. And so you've got these timelines that start running, the appellate timelines start running because a final judgment is treated that way. So the court, if the act of granting a new trial vacates that judgment, then, and it's not given good faith or credit in Texas, okay? So if it's vacated, it didn't happen, it goes away, then if the court does anything other than that, doesn't that just keep that clock ticking to where the motion for new trial is denied by operation of law, the judgment becomes good, and you can appeal that?
In the case of a denial of the motion for new trial where nothing is ruled upon, then yes, but this case is different than that.
How can a trial court keep that funding power open beyond the rules? In this circumstance, when this is treated like a final judgment.
Let me direct the court to Texas Civil Practices and Rules Code, section 35.003. Okay. In that statute section involving foreign judgments, and it says, and I'm quoting, "A filed foreign judgment has the same effect and is subject to the same procedures and necessary proceedings for reopening, vacating, staying, enforcing, or satisfying a judgment as a judgment in the court in which it's filed." Mm-hmm. And couple that with the trial court's ability to do a reasonable inquiry into the facts, and the trial court passed the inherent powers to set its own schedule once it decides there is a contested fact issue. There were contested fact issues in this case about service of process, whether Pennsylvania judgment or Pennsylvania had minimum contacts with Dr. Cotton. This required that we took depositions, written discovery subpoenas to the appellant's landlord to confirm, yes, the address.
But the point of that is the court either grants it or the court denies it at the end of the day. Either granted or denied. If it's granted, then we all go home as far as that proceeding is concerned. It's over. And so if the court does not grant it, the court denies it in 75 days.
Well, did not grant the motion for new trial, then yes. If it did nothing else, then yes.
And if it did grant it, then we all go home, as far as that proceeding is concerned. So what if two things happen? Either it was denied by operation of law, or we all go home.
I would vigorously contest the binary nature of the court's ability to resolve this.
So do you think the court can deny part and grant part?
I believe the court will bifurcate the evidentiary hearing that we have contested factual issues to allow the parties to develop the case where the court does not have to guess what occurred factually, whether there was underlying the service process, whether or not there were minimal contacts, which required us to take the deposition of the appellant, required us to get discovered. I mean, the time frames that we're talking about, it's not feasible or even possible to discover those. The trial court may be informed of these things.
And are there cases that have dealt with this sort of hybrid creature of grant in part and deny in part?
What I would direct the court to are cases in which they've had with discovery, a trial, that's been maintained, and evidentiary trial on the case of whether the investigation was proper. Did you see how legally those decisions come? That was decided in 2012 by this court. The case cited there is 2012. Westlaw 320-7247 with Justice Sutter, you were on that panel. The court considered the deposition testimony of the processor, Alex Longdon, when determining that the judgment can be served in the New York State judgment. And in fact, in that case, there are some parallels to this case as well. There's a full selection clause in our lease agreements. Just like they were in those agreements, the court felt the board judgment enforceable. So it's not the binary choice of enforced or don't enforce. Section 35.103 gives multiple other options, and the trial court does have the inherent power to bifurcate and allow the parties and the trial court itself to make a reasonable inquiry to test the factual issues. Otherwise, the court's hands are tied, and the appellees in this case, hands are tied, we wouldn't be able to do the proper investigation. I'd like to move on to statute of limitations, particular statute. Two important things. The rendition date, the commencement date, if you look at 16.066, undisputed that because of any judgment, November 2006, that the commencement of the investigation proceedings was 2012, as well as the continued statute of limitations. And I would also point out, section 10, finish the point now.
Yeah, this is just your time encroaching in his now.
I'll reserve time.
My name is Matthew Fraud, and I likewise represent the law of the Lending Financial Services. As a threshold issue for the substantive argument, the court has already heard of the case. The court must first determine whether a thought is properly preserved and presented any of the issues in which it presents. Particularly, we contend that a thought failed to preserve and present the issues in which it presents. First, and just as Kurt touched on the very part of this issue, a thought failed to preserve his complaint regarding allegedly improper service as a whole because he did not request a record of trial. The Texas Supreme Court in EMC Software Development, NAB versus Workman, as the case was cited in our brief, has expressly stated that a trial court must resolve numerous factual issues regarding service and the parties before you can get to the legal analysis of special interest. In this case, the trial court, in its final judgment, concluded that the Pennsylvania court had personal jurisdiction over the matter. The trial court held an evidentiary hearing on the exact issues that helped not request a report of record of action. Instead, appellant challenges the underlying services process without presenting any record of the evidence the trial court considered to support its conclusion. Appellant likewise never requested formal findings of fact and conclusions of law. The Texas Supreme Court American Private Culture Collection Inc. versus Coleman stated that when a trial court does not issue findings of fact, reviewing courts should presume the trial court resolved all factual disputes in favor of the judge. Accordingly, appellant failed to preserve the record and present this court with adequate information, we simply cannot review the trial court's decision.
Well, if the appellant is right, though, that the way that this happened between 2012 and 2016 really divested the trial court of any plenary power to do anything, if they're right about that, then they didn't need to give us a reporter's record or anything, did they?
Correct. These are all issues that are substantive as to the appellant's series of process arguments, which, if you're correct, we don't get to if the court doesn't have jurisdiction for that. As we were discussing earlier, that comes down to whether or not the trial is granted or denied. And one of the points that I would like to add to that is that the appellant's contention on that is that the motion for new trial is a misnomer, in that it doesn't get to new trial in future litigation, but it's a misnomer only in appellant's case. Because the motion for new trial, it can just set aside the trial, but it doesn't give you a new trial. And
would all this have been avoided if Judge Evans, the 48th District Court, in its order, rather than calling it and granting the motion for new trial, returned to its jurisdiction, was it truly a misnomer, was it almost like a show calls a word?
And that's what I'm getting at, Your Honor. If the order is on its face, an order that's saying, hey, we need to look into this motion, motion to adjourn, and notice that it's going to extend its inquiry. The fact that it is named a motion for new trial can't be a misnomer on its face, and then also a misnomer in that we don't want to trial. And that's what the court's doing. The court is clearly not setting aside the judgment as vacated or as void. It's just saying there's some key issues we need to look into. And then it does that. And those parties are disagreeable. And there's an evidentiary hearing after that, and there's no record for that. So with that, the record, the court can't review it. Additionally, I would like to touch on two brief points, and that is that the appellant's argument relies on Pennsylvania law. However, the appellant does comply with Rule 202 of Texas Rules of Evidence. Fundamentally, the service is proper under both Pennsylvania and Texas law, so either way, we get to the same result. Additionally, there's an inadequate briefing issue that's briefed in our appellant's brief, in that there's not a standard review cited in each case. That left us in the court somewhat guessing as to what it is the issues that were arguing specifically. And that's been recognized throughout Texas as well. Just studied that on our panel recently that recognized that in this court against King versus Highland County. So with that, if the court has no additional questions, I'll see you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.